Well, I just should start out by saying how happy I am to have such multiple connections with this great place. What I'll try today will be to give you an idea, not just to the experts on quantum gravity among you, but also to the rest of the audience, of what I do and what I find interesting, and what my hopes are, and whether we share any hopes. Okay, let me start by being slightly provocative and ask, well, does quantum gravity really exist? Well, you could certainly say there's little evidence that it does. In terms of phenomenology, well, it's basically a blank slate at this moment, although people, of course, are thinking about what might constitute a quantum gravity phenomenology. Now, certainly, we all know that gravity is very, very weak compared to the other fundamental interactions. So you might ask, well, perhaps it needn't be quantized. I would say that is certainly a pragmatic point of view, but it's not a point of view that most people would share, because they would argue, on general grounds, what we know about physics, the nature of physics, we would expect something of a quantum gravity theory to exist. And certainly, the burden would be also on you to show that if you claim that gravity needn't be quantized, that this is actually a consistent point of view in principle and in practice. So on the pro side, what reasons could you advance to say it seems very plausible and likely that gravity ought to be quantized? Well, first, of course, gravity classically is universal. By this I mean everything couples gravitationally to everything else. So everything, I mean everything that carries any form of matter or energy is of course subject to gravitational forces and in turn exerts such gravitational forces. Quantum theory, on the other hand, is also universal, well, in a slightly different way, in the sense that, as far as we know, all other theories of fundamental interactions at their heart are not classical theories, they are just quantum theories. So they are, in essence, quantum and classicality only comes about in a sufficient kind of in specific limits. It might be sufficient in special limits, but the world as such appears to be quantum. And also clearly we can think about situations where both gravitational effects and quantum effects ought to be important. Although, of course, these are not everyday lab experiments we have in mind, but certainly thinking back to the situation as it must have been at the beginning of the universe, very early universe, near the Big Bang, or what putatively goes on near black hole singularities, that seem to be kind of prime examples of where you expect that a quantum theory of gravity would be needed in order to describe the situation. But of course, perhaps the question is ill posed. So that's how some people would argue. So then that seems to be, to me, more of a linguistic issue in the sense that, of course, you can always ask, well, what does govern dynamics on very short scales? What kind of degrees of freedom take over, perhaps quite beyond what we would expect by some naive extrapolation from the macroscopic degrees of freedom of gravity, so the curvature degrees of freedom of space-time, if you like. So something else might, of course, be there at the Planck scale or beyond. That could be free geometry, space-time foam. Of course, people have long drawn these qualitative pictures, like here at the bottom. Maybe it's causal sets. Maybe there is some fundamental discrete structure there. We don't know. But let us agree to call whatever is there, let us agree to call this quantum gravity, so just to fix a language. But let me assume, and I don't think it's a particularly strong assumption based on everything we know about nature, that there is something rather than nothing. So in other words, that we can play our big and so far extremely successful a game of reductionism, of trying to explain structures in physics we see by microscopic, in terms of microscopic building laws, in terms of more microscopic fundamental laws. Let us assume that this can be applied to include gravity, be it in the context of a grand unification or otherwise. Okay, now let's make, what is the status quo? So how many theories of quantum gravity are there? By a theory of quantum gravity, I fear defined it at the bottom, I mean an interacting quantum theory, quantum field theory of geometry, which reproduces the classical theory of general relativity at sufficiently large scales and low energies, but at the same time makes new and non-trivial predictions that come essentially from the quantum nature of the theory. Okay, now the evidence so far is, of course, zero. No such theories have been uncovered, at least not, you know, any that satisfy a reasonable degree of completeness. So for the purpose of the argument of, you know, doing the counting or of classifying potential quantum gravity theories, let me advance the following classification. So let me call little n the number of free parameters that my candidate quantum gravity possesses, and by m, little m, the number of independent observations available to me to fix the values of these free parameters. And, you know, just to, as a broad sketch, let us distinguish two cases. So case one, let n be a small finite number. So it just means that your candidate theory depends on a few free parameters. And of course, currently, certainly m is also not a big number. If you're really talking about, you know, quantum gravity effects proper, then probably m is very close to zero. Okay, so that is case one. N is small finite and roughly of the same order as m. Good. Special case would be n is actually zero. So the theory would just be unique. It would just, you know, spit out the values of all relevant coupling constants for you. Now, case two is another extreme where little m is much, much bigger than small m. So there are many, many more free parameters than we could possibly ever hope to fix by making observations or experiments. And, you know, just arbitrary special cases I picked here, n might be 10 to the 500, seems a popular number sometimes, or n might actually be infinite. And we see that we are somewhat in trouble if you're really after a predictive theory, where after fixing, you know, a finite number of free constants, we can then start making actual predictions. So we're in trouble in case two. We might be okay in case one. So what I would argue, if I'm interested in trying to understand the dynamics of quantum gravity, that clearly our best hope is that one is the case, is realized in nature. In the old days, it was certainly so that also string theory was thought to be unique. And inasmuch as quantum gravity is part and parcel of a string theory, that was believed to fall under case one. But this is no longer the case, apparently. So there are many, many more free parameters and ingredients that the theory by now has to more fall under category two than one. So what I, for the purposes of this talk, I want to call the new best hope is that actually very little is needed in terms of extra ingredients. I write here fancy ingredients. By that, I mean ingredients that you have to postulate to be present beyond what you already know to be there simply from the classical theory. So examples of that would be extra object in the theory, strings, brains, loops, extra symmetries, supersymmetry, even more extended, say infinite dimensional symmetries. Our best hope maybe is that none of this paraphernalia is needed, perhaps, to understand quantum gravity. It doesn't at all mean that it's wrong or that a theory working with such ingredients is wrong, but maybe we are lucky, we can just hope, that it's not needed. And, of course, you would be right in asking me to present some evidence that this is actually a realistic scenario. And that's what I'm going to do for you in the rest of this talk. So let me move on to an example of a candidate theory for quantum gravity that is based, has very few free parameters. So it has a high degree of uniqueness, which is, of course, great if it's actually true. And it's not based on anything more than kind of standard quantum field theoretic ingredients and tools. So, and this goes by the name of causal dynamical triangulation. That more characterizes the method, so I should say the approach I want to follow is called quantum gravity from the method of causal dynamical triangulation. And I should right away mention the collaborators who have contributed to work I'm reporting about today. There are Jan Ambjørn, who was briefly here a couple of weeks ago from the University of Copenhagen. There are Jurek Jurkiewicz and Andrzej Görlich from the University of Krakow. And Samuel Jordan and Paul Reska are PhD students of mine at Utrecht. And Igor Hafkin, former Canadian from close to here, is now a postdoc at Utrecht. So this CDT framework is what I would call a no-frills, non-perturbative implementation of the gravitational path integral. So it's a covariant approach where the path integral is central, and it is set up very much in the spirit of lattice theory, of the types that have been very successfully used, for instance, to try and understand non-perturbative properties of QCD, say. But now, of course, we are dealing with a theory whose dynamical degrees of freedom are the curvature of space-time, so space-time itself, so the way the local structure of empty space-time, to start with, itself, and that will be reflected in the way we set up the theory. So, for example, the kind of the lattice structure we'll work with will not be a fixed, you know, regular lattice like you would be used to when doing kind of standard, relativistic quantum field theory on a lattice or lattice version thereof, but that will be dynamical. And you'll see how this is reflected in setting up the path integral. Now, there are already a few nice results that have come out of this way of doing things. And it's, of course, it hasn't been invented yesterday. My collaborators and I have worked on this since 1998. That was kind of the time when we started with the germ of the idea, and it has taken a long time to verify that everything is as it should to start with the lower dimensions. But, of course, you have to set up then also a calculational framework in higher dimensions and then see what happens there. Now, the key result for which you would say, now this is genuinely interesting, this new approach, is that it has managed to produce from pure quantum dynamics, so not putting in any, so working, I should say, in a background independent formalism, so not in any way putting, using a given preferred geometry, say as a starting point for a perturbation theory, so being background independent and being at the same time non-perturbative, that is allowing contributions in your path integral that are potentially very, very far from any classical solution to contribute. In this framework, we've managed from just first principles, kind of a quantum dynamics, and very simple ingredients to kind of find a ground state of quantum geometry coming out of the non-perturbative path integral that shares intriguingly features with a classical solution to the Einstein equations. And as you'll see, so the picture up is up there, so that is one of the configurations that come out of a Monte Carlo simulation of this model in four dimensions. And this illustrates to you some feature of macroscopic geometry that come out. And I'll explain this in more detail later. What we find there is a De Sitter space, a Euclideanized version of a De Sitter space. Now, to my knowledge, this so far hasn't been achieved in any other approach to quantum gravity, which starts from this kind of microscopic ingredients to show that there is kind of a stable ground state of extended geometry, which can serve as, on macroscopic scales, to approximate, kind of semi-classically, a solution to the Einstein equations. Okay, now, talking about basic tools. So that's the good old path integral applied to the case of gravity. So what the graph up there illustrates is actually a computer simulation for a one-dimensional non-relativistic particle. So the path integral of that, so the sum over amplitudes after Wick rotation, of the one-dimensional harmonic oscillator. So the situation depicted here is that you're looking for to evaluate the path integral, or the propagator of the theory, if you like, where you fixed an initial and an endpoint, xi and xf, and then consider a superposition of all paths, or a Euclidean, a Wick-rotated version of that, and you see the individual paths here have been regularized, and they are given by piecewise straight paths, as you can see up in the picture. And, of course, we know that this is a well-defined procedure to start with this regularized set of paths and then refine them. It's a well-defined procedure to actually define the quantum dynamics of the non-relativistic particle in a completely equivalent way to what you would get if you just solved the Schrödinger equation, say. So here it plays out the way it plays out for the one-dimensional particle. So what you're then interested in, or what, how you can characterize the general solution, is that the trajectory x of t consists of kind of the semi-classical trajectory given as the expectation value of x of t plus fluctuations. And, of course, these quantum fluctuations have a scale, and in the particle case, the scale is set by the length scale is set by square root of h bar over m omega. And you see, of course, for example, that if you make m large, then these are highly suppressed. Now, in quantum gravity, we want to do something very similar. We want to set up a path integral. We want to superpose all paths our own universe can take. And we want then to figure out what the expectation value of the geometry is, only that now the typical length scale involved, say for the perhaps resulting quantum universe, will be dictated by a length scale that's the Planck length, and that is therefore proportional to square root of h bar g Newton. But otherwise, well, that's the path we want to follow. Okay, now, so how does that work? Well, what one writes down is kind of the gravitational path integral, and it's also somewhat more grandly called the sum over histories, because while we're dealing with our universe or a piece of our universe, so how it has developed throughout time. So I abbreviate the path integral by the symbol z. I make it depend on two coupling constants to start with, just g Newton and a cosmological term. And these are, of course, they reappear in the action. So each of the paths, or rather the histories of the universe I'm summing over or integrating over, on the right-hand side of that equation, gets a weight That is, e to the I, the classical action. Of course, in the same way, you did it for the particle case. This is here the Einstein-Hilbert action. So you get a superposition of these complex amplitudes. So what I always like to say is that kind of this expression, this formal expression, is just so ill-defined in so many different ways that it probably wins competition for the worst defined relation of that type in theoretical physics. And maybe that's why people love it so much. Now, there are many, many issues one has to address here, and that are clearly not spelled out by just writing down this formal relation. So certainly, of course, we're dealing with a quantum field theory. So, well, we expect infinities, of course. So certainly one thing I will have to do is to regularize so that the right-hand side becomes kind of finite and meaningful, and I can, in a meaningful way, talk about its behavior, say, in certain limits. Another thing I will have to do is I have to parameterize the space I want to integrate over. So what is my space of paths? You know, how do I get a handle on the space of all spaces, or the space of all space geometries, space-time geometries? So that is the kind of space I'm asked to integrate over here. And so here down there, each of them, so the weights, the Einstein-Hilbert action I've just written down, just for reference, consists here of the scalar curvature term R, and for generality, but we will actually need it in the formalism I'll be talking about, a cosmological constant term, depending on this cosmological constant, positive cosmological constant, capital lambda. So the issue is, can one make this well-defined in some way? Now, a key step one uses in the setup of dynamical triangulations is to regularize the geometries in a specific way. And you could say you do it in a way that is inspired by what you did for the path of the non-relativistic particle that entered into the finite dimensional construction of that path integral leading to Wiener measure, etc. Now, the closest analog, in a way, is to describe arbitrary smooth curved space-times by triangulations. Now, why are these simpler objects? Well, you're supposed, if you just look at the genus zero world sheet up there on the left, you see, well, it's a curved surface, you know, with the topology of a sphere. I have approximated its geometrical properties by triangulating it by large triangles and by fine triangles in order to capture its curvature properties. So the triangles themselves are by definition flat, and curvature only comes into play in the way you glue these together pairwise. And it's kind of obvious that if you refine your triangulations, you'll be able to better and better approximate any given curved, in this case, two-dimensional surface. But you can apply the very same constructions also in higher dimensions. Then instead of flat triangles, you use flat higher dimensional triangles. So in three dimensions, this would be tetrahedra. In four dimensions, well, they don't have special names. You call them four simplices. In five dimensions, you call them five simplices, etc. So the underlying idea is that the triangulation provides a regularization of geometry and an approximation, in a way, that substitutes what is a field theoretic configuration by a finite bunch of numbers. And the numbers, in this case, will always be kind of the edge lengths of your triangles, and you have, of course, to keep track of how you glued the triangles together pairwise to get kind of an extended piece of space or space-time. This is all a really old idea, and in physics goes back to Tullio Regge's idea, published in 1961, of doing general relativity based where you describe your space-times, by these piecewise flat or piecewise straight objects that are, of course, much simpler. So you could just think of, for the purpose, say, of solving the classical Einstein equations, to have an approximation scheme where you are operating with these triangulations instead of smooth four geometries. And the nice feature about this is that you're not introducing coordinates. You don't have to. And you, well, in this scheme, you don't want to. Now, why is that very convenient to have? Because, of course, the way that four-dimensional geometries are usually given to us, say we open, you know, a textbook on general relativity, is in terms of coordinate systems and assignments of metrics G mu nu. Of course, the problem with that is that these are the G mu nu's. They are redundant, highly redundant variables because their explicit form changes under coordinate transformations. So two metrics may look very, very different but have exactly the same physical content if they're related by kind of a gauge transformation, by a coordinate transformation. But what you want to do, certainly also for the purpose of quantizing the theory, you just want to have the physical degrees of freedom and quantize those. So there is certainly a hope that if you base yourself on a formulation like this, this will already take care of part of the problem you have with quantizing gravity, namely to parameterize in a convenient manner the space of geometries, so where you've got rid already of the coordinate redundancy. Now, what will certainly be very different in the quantum theory from the classical theory is that your primary purpose in the quantum theory is not to approximate with arbitrary precision a given smooth geometry. What you want to do in the quantum theory instead is you want to approximate the space of all geometries, because that is the space you want to integrate over in the path integral. And what is already completely clear, say, even when from comparing, say, with a simple case of the non-relativistic particle even, is that very non-classical paths will contribute significantly to such a path integral construction. So paths that are kind of very far away from any given classical path. And so here, this picture I put down for you there comes from a toy model of two-dimensional Euclidean quantum gravity, where you're summing over curved surfaces of a given topology, say, again, a sphere. And here is an artistic impression of a typical contribution to the path integral. Typical means you take the ensemble of all of these objects, you just pick one out blindly, and it will tend to look like this. So very, very non-classical. So that just to give you an idea. So what we do is we discretize the path integral in terms of these triangulations. In lower dimensions, that means particularly two, but three to some extent, there are then analytical methods by which you can try and evaluate these objects after recrotation, I should say. So they are then real. You're talking about summing over real Boltzmann weights, not over complex amplitudes. However, in dimension higher than three, certainly, there are currently no analytic ways to evaluate the path integrals that appear. And it's clearly a very difficult task, and the only thing we know to do currently to really evaluate these non-perturbative quantities is to do it with the help of the computer, is using the computer simulations. Okay, now, let me spell it out a little more precisely, but I'm not going to be very technical for the purposes of today's talk. So what becomes of this formal path integral, so I've written it down again there on the left, the sum over histories, the integration over all geometries, which are called little g, space-time geometries, which are called little g, it is replaced in this regularization method using causal dynamical triangulations by a sum. And the sum is now over triangulated manifold, so-called simplicial manifolds, subject to certain boundary conditions, which you can pick. usually we choose them to be kind of simple, to make our life easy. And what appears on the right-hand side is essentially the triangulated version of the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is not due to us, but is something that already Reggie wrote down in the old days. So I call this the Reggie action. So there's still the complex weights at this stage. And the measure is 1 divided by C of T. So capital T is a triangulation in my ensemble of triangulations, these simplicial objects. And C of T is a dimension of the automorphism group of a given triangulation T. So that means if you have now such a gluing of 4 simplices, it just can happen that it has non-trivial symmetries by which I can map the thing onto itself and get the same thing back again. So it's like, you know, in the continuum, I have a metric with special symmetries, you know, say isometries. Now this can happen. There is kind of, you can think of that as a version in the space of triangulations. And whenever that is the case, you divide out by the size of that automorphism group. Otherwise, kind of the assumption that goes into this is that each geometry has equal weight. So this is democracy of space-time geometries. So that, in a way, is also an assumption you're putting in there. So they compete with each other on the same footing. Now, so, and below that, I've again just written down what becomes of the individual smooth geometry you're summing over or integrating over in this formal continuum path integral. It is now substituted by a gluing or a triangulation, capital T, that consists of n building blocks, and the fine-grainedness of the triangulation is characterized by the typical edge length of these simplicial building blocks, and I call this little a. And now what I want to do, or what I need to do, in order to get rid of the regularization, which I've introduced now at an intermediate stage, to make the problem calculable, to make it manageable, to be able to discuss its properties, say its convergence properties, I have to take a limit where a, this kind of UV, you can think of as like a UV cutoff, is sent to zero. And at the same time, of course, the number of my building blocks goes to infinity for the case that I want to keep some finite physical length fixed and think of a, you know, continuous refinement, refinement, further refinement. And in this limit, I then study quantities that interest me. So the path integral, certain observables, expectation values of interesting observables. And I see, in particular also, how they behave as a function of these cutoff parameters, these regularization parameters, and that gives me important information about a potential, the existence of a continuum limit, and also its properties, if such a thing indeed is present. So below there, here are 2 artistic renderings of the type of building blocks that you have in this scheme of causal dynamical triangulations, something I don't really have to too much time, or rather no time at all, to explain to you today, is that I need, if one does, well, people started using such a framework a long time ago, but they did it for the Euclidean theory. So instead of starting out with triangulations of Lorentzian four-dimensional curve manifolds, they started out with the equivalent, but not the equivalent, with the Euclidean objects. So instead of summing over four-dimensional space times, they were summing over four-dimensional spaces, which have no notion of time or of causality. And unfortunately, one couldn't make any sense of that in the sense that no good continuum limits seem to exist of these purely Euclidean models, which generated macroscopic four-dimensional geometry in some kind of continuum limit. Yes, there's a question. Actually, yes, it is. I mean, this, in my formalism, actually, I allow only for 2 edge lengths. And since I'm in the Lorentzian framework, I allow for a typical space-like edge length. I just call it A squared. And a time-like edge length, which is whatever, minus A squared, or you can also introduce another relative scaling constant for the time-like edges. So indeed, what I do here, and that is slightly different from what one would do in ratchet calculus, where one leaves the edge length variable and keeps the triangulation fixed. What I do here, I essentially allow only for two different types of edge lengths to appear, and therefore I have only in four dimensions these two types of building blocks and their inverses in a way, and I vary the way of gluing them together, assembling them to get kind of all possible four-dimensional curved objects. So it's kind of complementary to what one does in ratchet calculus. And while this procedure turns, I should also say, turns out to just work very beautifully in two dimensions. And in two dimensions, kind of both for Euclidean quantum gravity, just the toy model, and Lorentzian quantum gravity, which is also just the toy model, you can just follow this procedure to the end. You can just analytically solve the thing. And for example, if you follow this dynamical triangulations, a quantization path for the Euclidean, in the Euclidean signature, you rederive what is usually called Liouville gravity. So you have already very nice examples of where this particular procedure seems to do just the right thing. So when you compare it with a continuum construction in a very simple case in two dimensions where you can kind of do either thing. So just getting back to the point, so causality is essential. And the way it's built into my framework of causal dynamical triangulations is, first of all, that each of the building blocks I have there is a piece of Minkowski space. So everywhere I know where the light cones, the light rays go within such a four simplex. And I also glue these things together so I have an overall time flow. And even more than that, it turns out that I have, in order for this to yield a good continuum limit, I have to arrange things in such a way that my space-time geometry becomes kind of sliced. And I have a preferred global time parameter which labels this, the slicing. First, to start with, in this discretized setting, but of course later on I take a continuum limit of that where the slices then become very, very thin. But nevertheless, there is a notion of global time in here which turns out to be essential in leading you to the result that comes out of this particular construction, as opposed to the very degenerate results that were generated in the Euclidean counterpart of this model, in higher dimension, I should say, in dimension higher, three and higher. Now, kind of what my logic kind of should already have led you towards is a kind of statistical mechanical way of thinking about gravity, namely as involving sums over certain geometric objects. And of course, what we need to do is that we need to recrotate to make them into actual well-defined statistical systems. So let me just dwell for a minute on some of the kind of analogies or some of the features that appear in following this quantization approach to gravity, and comparing this to, well, what one does, the kind of ingredients that appear in statistical mechanical systems. So the first statement is that if I now start with my Lorentzian triangulated, dynamically triangulated space-times, and there are, of course, many, many, many of those, there is actually a nice map that maps one of these Lorentzian triangulations in a unique way to a Euclidean geometry of the same kind. So it's piecewise flat geometry. And not just that, this map does exactly what you would like it to do, namely, if you look at what the complex amplitude e to the is is turned into after you've performed kind of this recrotation, then it's actually turned into e to the Boltzmann weight, e to the minus the Euclidean action of the weak rotated geometry. And the prescription is actually extremely simple at the level of the triangulation. You substitute everything that was a time-like edge in your causal dynamical triangulation by a space-like edge. And the only thing that kind of appears there as a kind of a parameter you weak rotate is kind of the length of that of a generic time-like edge, which you rotate kind of from Lorentzian with a length, you know, minus a squared, to a Euclidean one with some length up to some constant, possibly plus a squared. So you have a weak rotation here, and this is exceptional because we don't actually know of any such prescription in the continuum. We'd love to have this for general curved geometries, but we don't. So this we have in this framework, and we use it to turn what was a complex quantum amplitude into a real kind of partition function, which we then try to evaluate. And of course, the idea is to evaluate that in the Euclidean regime, and then, well, look at the final result. And of course, your task is to rotate this back or to interpret it in terms of Lorentzian signature objects. And in general, this will be not at all trivial. So for some objects, for some observables, that might be relatively straightforward, but in general, you would expect it to be very, very non-trivial. So, but this is the underlying logic here. Okay, I have already said that I am unable to evaluate the full non-perturbative path integral in higher dimensions analytically, not even, you know, in some asymptotic regime. It's just too difficult. It doesn't mean it cannot at all be done, but it's tricky. So it actually involves it. The way I've, you know, discretized my configuration space here actually turns in a certain way the evaluation, the problem of the evaluation of the path integral into a combinatorial problem. Because basically my building blocks are all identical units, essentially. And what I'm evaluating is kind of the combinatorics of the different ways in which I can stick them together to generate, you know, a large geometry. So if I had a good handle on this combinatorial problem in four dimensions, I would probably be able to make progress in an analytic evaluation of the path integral. But this is not exactly simple. Okay, so I have already explained that I do my computation in the Euclidean regime. There I want to take a continuum limit, and of course what you know from statistical systems is that taking a continuum limit will usually also involve a specific behavior and renormalization of the bare coupling constants that went into defining the discretized model. And the very same thing will be true here also. And one thing you can do after you've performed the weak rotation, you can just analyze the so-called phase structure of the underlying statistical mechanical system. So it's a dynamics on a certain ensemble of these triangulated geometries with certain Boltzmann weights. And we've done that a long time ago, actually some years ago, and recently we've kind of gone back and refined our measurements. So what are the bare parameters that appear in this formulation? Well, there are basically three of them. So I illustrate them here. So I have a three-dimensional phase diagram, but where I use phase diagram in the sense of statistical mechanics. So I have, this is a coupling constant space. Kappa naught is essentially the inverse Newton constant. Little lambda is essentially the bare cosmological constant. And the third axis, kind of going there to the back, I call capital delta. And the capital delta naturally appears in the discretized setup as a finite relative scaling between space-like directions and time-like directions. Its ultimate meaning, whether it actually has a physical meaning that survives in the continuum limit, is not completely understood as yet. But the essential thing is that we have a three-dimensional parameter space, and we now can study our model, its behavior, as a function of where we are in this phase space. And this is what we've done. So up there, you see how these bare coupling constants appear in the Regge action. The Kappa node, these are the discretized versions of the curvature term, of the volume cosmological constant term, and then you see you have a piece where explicitly this asymmetry parameter delta appears. N4 are the number of building blocks, the number of force simplices, and there were two types of them, which I had on the previous picture. So you can count, we count them separately, and they appear both up there. So what happens is that in order, so that's the first finding, in order to have a well-defined infinite volume limit, we have to place ourselves on a two-dimensional sub-manifold of the three-dimensional phase diagram. So it's this curved manifold that appears kind of halfway up there. And so physics, and that is obtained, I should say furthermore, by fine-tuning the bare cosmological constant appropriately. I mean, by fine-tuning it, and by that you achieve that arbitrarily large triangulations contribute significantly to your partition function. If you're away from the surface, large triangulations will be suppressed, will be actually exponentially suppressed, and you'll never get any interesting kind of infinite volume limit out. Now, once we sit on this hypersurface, where we fine-tuned lambda, we still have two directions to move around them, and what we find there is three different phases, which are characterized here by A, B, and C. So we have a critical surface, and we find very different behavior for the kind of quantum geometry kind of that comes out of the path integral, if you like, the nature of the ground state in the sense that it is a state that minimizes the Wittig-rotated Euclidean action. So it's very different in phase A, B, and C. And here I have a few pictures for you. So in phase A, that occurs for sufficiently large inverse Newton coupling, this kappa naught, we find what I'm plotting here is a typical shape of the universe as a function of time, where by shape, I simply mean it's three volume. So I have compact slices. I do my simulations by fixing the space-time topology to be an interval, a time interval, or sometimes I even compactify the time interval, times a compact spatial slice, which is topologically in S3. So these are kind of the boundary conditions that go into this. And what I then can monitor as a function of time is simply the size or the three-dimensional volume as in time evolution. So in phase A up there, I find this highly oscillatory behavior for the total volume, the three volume. In phase B, something else bizarre happens. It seems that the entire universe collapses in the time direction kind of to a single spatial slice. And you might be tempted to jump to the conclusion that this will now be a three-dimensional universe, but actually when you start measuring its geometric properties, it turns out to be nothing of the kind. So, for instance, it has a Hausdorff dimension that appears to be infinite. So it's not any nice classical object. This leaves us with phase C. And this is where all kind of the beautiful features happen. So there, we do indeed find a whole region where we seem to have an extended a ground state. And here, well, is my previous picture again. So we call this a volume profile. So if I now pick, you know, a typical member of the ensemble, when I'm in phase C, that means I have my coupling constants, kappa naught and delta lie in a specific range, then I will find volume profiles that look qualitatively like the one I'm showing here. And of course, what I have to do, this is just a single Monte Carlo simulation, of course, in order to determine kind of the quantum average of that shape, I have to make this measurement over many, 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 many configurations. And we do that, of course, we average over millions of configurations. And then we get to expectation values that then have a direct physical meaning, unlike individual path integral histories, which individually, well, do not have usually a direct physical meaning. There is here a very short slice. Let me not specifically dwell on this. If we now place ourselves on this two-dimensional phase diagram where we have already fine-tuned the cosmological constant, we have now measured in more detail what happens in various regions of the phase diagram. And in particular, of course, one is interested in the nature, more specifically, the order of the phase transitions between these three phases, A, B, and C. So here you see the pictures again. You see how geometry is characterized. And what this picture does is to say, hey, look, this is a diagram with three phases that looks very, very much like a phase diagram of a Lifshitz-type statistical mechanical system. So these Lifshitz systems are systems that also allow for certain anisotropies. So these systems, they have typically a kind of a free energy, so kind of in a mean field approximation, capital F, as I've written down there, and depending on positivity, negativity of the constants A, C, and D that appear in this mean field expression, you find yourself in different phases. Say, if you are in a look at a magnetic incarnation of such a system, you would find a ferromagnetic phase corresponding to a kind of a constant magnetization, and that is kind of would be phase C, the analog of our phase C. You'd find a paramagnetic phase with no magnetization, and that would be the analog of B. But because of certain anisotropic features you've introduced, you've allowed in this model, you also have what is usually called a helical phase, where you can find, well, strongly oscillatory behavior. And that is kind of the analog of my phase A. So there is actually a tantalizing analogy with the Lifshitz diagram, where even features of the geometry seem to be reminiscent of, well, constancy, what this will turn out to be the Sitter space up there in phase C, strong oscillations. They turn out to be related to excitation of the conformal factor in gravity, and then, well, something bizarre down here, which is kind of no geometry, something we don't quite understand. So there is kind of a vague analogy which still needs, we still hope to be able to make more specific, that identifies magnetization as an order parameter with something that is geometry, perhaps, or just a scale factor, and that looks extremely similar. Both of these phase diagrams look very similar to each other. And one might wonder to what extent this phase structure is generic, say, for systems of higher dimensional geometry, and what features of the various phases are actually generic, far beyond the particular model models we've been studying. Okay, now from this, let me now go to semi-classical behavior as it comes out in this phase C. So I showed you this, the picture of the pink universe, and I said, well, look, this is just a volume profile just of a randomly chosen path history. And of course, it doesn't reflect, you know, all the local quantum wiggles that go on. The only thing I'm monitoring is the volume as a function of time, the three volume. Now, if I now take the large statistics in order to evaluate the expectation value of this volume profile, this is what I get. So what this curve here depicts is, as a function of time, kind of in discrete steps, so here my quantum universe has length, or the total universe is of length 80 in discrete units, you see an extended universe exists only for part of that time, otherwise it's kind of pinched off, and then I have a specific shape for the volume. And very beautifully, the shape is exactly matched by the volume profile of a Euclidean de Sitter space. And here I've written down for you kind of the de Sitter metric in proper time form, which is the appropriate coordinatization to compare to my kind of proper time-sliced framework. And you see you have the dt squared. We are in Euclidean, so it's a plus dt squared. And then my scale factor, so this little a of t, which just characterizes the linear size of my universe at a given time, is of the form of a cosine, right? And of course, you can immediately derive from this cosine as a function of time. You can immediately derive from this three-dimensional volume profile, and the measured curves from the simulations on this picture are virtually indistinguishable from the theoretical curve. The red things, they're not error bars, but they quantify the size of the quantum, typical quantum fluctuations we found for the universes we have studied. Of course, we have studied these universes for a particular range of coupling constants, and that entails a specific size. And actually, our universes are very, very small. They are of 10, 20 Planck lengths across, and this explains why you see here quantum fluctuations, well, appreciable quantum fluctuations at all. If the universe were much bigger, then the quantum fluctuations would be just tiny, and you wouldn't be able to see them at all. So we are working with very small universes, and we see the quantum effects there. Now, one can do more than this. One can quantitatively analyze the behavior of the quantum fluctuations around this dynamically generated semi-classical, on large scales, kind of semi-classical ground state. And this is we have done. And you can compare it to a perturbation second order expansion in a mini superspace cosmology around the de Sitter space. Now, a very interesting thing that has happened, however, which I should point you to, something very interesting that has happened in order to bring about this de Sitter behavior in the path integral here, I have evaluated, is completely different from what happens when you do cosmology or quantum cosmology. You see, if you do quantum cosmology for the scale factor, so you say, oh yeah, let my universe be isotropic and homogeneous, that reduces, of course, a huge space of physical degrees of freedom to a single mechanical variable, namely exactly this A of T, the scale factor. Let me look at this, let me take this seriously as a classical system, let me quantize that, say, by a path integral quantization. It looks very simple, but you immediately run into trouble, because in the action, if you look at what the induced mini superspace action is, the scale factor A enters with a kinetic term that has just the wrong sign. There's, of course, a famous kind of conformal sickness of the action, of the gravitational action, which is due to this kind of strange inverted behavior of the conformal mode of the metric. So the conformal mode, the global conformal mode is, of course, just the global size of the universe, but there's also a local conformal mode that tells you how the local g mu nu kind of scales by an overall factor. And all of these modes enter into the action, both the Euclidean action and the Lorentzian action, with the opposite sign of the kinetic term, which makes this action unbounded, and which, of course, in principle, renders any path integral, I mean, it spells big trouble for any path integral quantization. So, and certainly this is the case when you first reduce and then try to evaluate this finite dimensional path integral, say, in a cosmological context. Then you're hit by the fact that, I've rewritten the scale factor. I've rewritten it as a function of the three volume V3, but you see the very same behavior. You get a term, a kinetic term, which has a minus sign instead of a plus sign there. So this is just the mini superspace cosmology. Now, how did our formalism deal with this? We also have an action, and we have done nothing to the action. So these conformal modes sit in our action, and they contribute with the same wrong sign. One can immediately see this. So why, however, is our path integral not ill-defined? Because it appears that there are contributions from the measure of the path integral. So if you like, the collective effect of all the other degrees of freedom, which counteract, if you like, or actually manage to take care of these divergent conformal modes as they appear in the bare action. And in such a way that when I'm in a suitable region of my phase space, kind of the positive definite kinetic term wins over the negative part that comes from the bare action. So this is what seems to be happening here, and this is what seems to underlie the nice semi-classical results we find here, and the nice matching with kind of expected semi-classical things. So what is hidden there is really something highly non-trivial that is going on in our non-perturbative construction. And this is what this, this slide here is meant to highlight. Really, our semi-classicality, so like the de Sitter space we find, comes out of our construction, is of a non-perturbative nature. So it's nothing you could have guessed just by staring at the bare action alone. So it comes about because of a subtle interplay of entropy and energy, kind of to use a Euclidean statistical mechanics language. So only in this way can we actually come up, can it appear at happen at all that we find an action, a Euclidean action, whose minimum appears to be a de Sitter space. Of course, in the standard action, the de Sitter space is at most a saddle point. And clearly, we wouldn't be able to see what we are seeing if that was also the case here. So something very non-trivial has happened. This is not magic. There are well-known examples in low-dimensional statistical systems where the very same phenomenon is observed. And here what I'm quoting to you here is the famous Kosterlitz-Saulus transition in the XY spin model. What is this model? Very briefly, it consists of unit spins, two-dimensional unit spins, spins of unit lengths, with nearest neighbor interactions that live on a two-dimensional lattice array, say a square grid. So down here, well, you see the little arrows there. Now, the interesting thing about this is that this model has two phases, one in which a high-temperature phase where vortex configurations dominate, and the vortices I have, you know, are drawn in here, it's just kind of the centers of the vortices are red, there's an anti-vortex that is green. It just means if you walk around the vortex, then you'll see that these spins, they will, you know, do like they will turn around in one direction or the other, depending on what type of vortex you have. Now, there is also a low temperature phase where no such vortices are present. And on top of that, there is a qualitative way of understanding why you have these two phases, and it's again an example where entropy and energy compete with each other to produce one or the other effect. Now, the way this comes out here is we have a kind of free energy associated with this model, which in a certain region of coupling space that interests us now can be well approximated by, well, the spin, this is still the sum of the full spin configurations, but in the relevant region which interests us, the spin configuration can be kind of saturated by particularly simple spin configurations that have a single vortex in them. And the energy of such a state is just written there, is kappa. Kappa is the spin coupling, log of R over A. R is the linear extension of the system. A is the distance of adjacent lattice points. So R over A is essentially the discrete size of this lattice in one of the directions. R over A squared is a number of, I mean, ignoring boundary terms, etc., is a number of vertices that sit in this lattice, a piece of lattice. Now, in a region where the dominant contribution in this sum comes from these single rotor excitations, it's very easy to evaluate the sum Z. Namely, you stick in the energy, and then you simply count how many states there are that have a single vortex in them. And of course, there are exactly as many of these states as I have lattice sites. So their number is R over A squared. So this is the expression right at the end of this line there. So what I have a partition function which has a contribution from entropy, just number of states, and from energy. And note that you can write the entropy contribution as an exponential of a function that looks exactly like the energy contribution up to constant. And that is just written down there. So if you put it up in the exponent, you see that both are proportional to log R over A. So clearly these two terms compete very directly in the free energy. And now depending on how I tune the spin coupling kappa, I can make F vanish, I can make it larger or bigger than zero. And making F vanish exactly characterizes, in this case, kind of the phase transition between having vortices around and having no vortices. But this is non-perturbative in the same way as kind of our implementation of quantum gravity seems to be non-perturbative. So we get, actually, if you look now at this phase transition, you can take a continuum limit, you get, well, a Sine-Gordon model, essentially. However, this has absolutely nothing to do with kind of the naive weak coupling limit of the spin model, which is just kind of a free Gaussian theory. So this is a kind of non-perturbative example of where you have exactly a competition of energy versus entropy, and of course it brings about a totally new, qualitatively new result. So this is further explained in this paper, which would have already been put on the net if I hadn't been preparing this talk and doing a few other things. Okay, I'm getting towards the end of my talk. There's one thing I still wanted to mention, another very nice result that comes out of this approach of causal dynamical triangulations, which now pertains not to the large-scale structure, which is good to have because your quantum gravity should have a good classical limit. That is clearly one of the key requirements of any quantum gravity theory. But it also gives you a glimpse of what happens microscopically and of the fact that really, as you kind of naively expected, at or near the Planck scale, geometry is totally non-classical. The observable I'm talking about is a so-called spectral dimension. And the spectral dimension is a property of an object that can be a manifold or something much more general. It could be a fractal. And you obtain it by setting up a diffusion process in the object, on the space, whatever you're looking at. So imagine someone hands you an unknown space, you know, or object, and it's your task to determine what the dimension is. Then you might resort to setting up a diffusion process in this and watching or monitoring how the diffusion process spreads from some initial point. So like kind of the diffusion cloud, you know, imagine putting a drop of ink in a bucket of water. From that, you can deduce how the effective dimension that diffusion process feels. And that's called the spectral dimension. It's a very generic concept, so we can use it to understand the dimensionality of the quantum geometry that comes out of our CDT path integral. And very, very surprisingly, what comes out is kind of schematically illustrated by this graph. When we look on large scales or long diffusion times sigma, which is equivalent, we find that the dimensionality, the spectral dimension of our space is 4. And this is exactly the classical value it would have if it was just a normal curved, you know, manifold, four-dimensional in the standard sense. However, when you go to short diffusion times, which probe short-scale properties of your quantum geometries, this dynamically generated quantum geometry, so this de Sitter universe, actually the spectral dimension becomes smaller, so it continuously drops down to a value near 2. We don't actually know that it's exactly 2, but it's certainly compatible with 2. Of course, what this indicates, and what, I mean, the fact that I have a continuous curve there indicates, is that this cannot possibly be interpreted as a classical manifold with standard metric properties, because there is no space that has, you know, a changing dimensionality as you look at it on short scales. So this is something that has come out of our approach, but very interestingly, other approaches that are also of a covariant nature, kind of very kind of conservative quantum field theoretic approaches, have reproduced since then, since we came up with this result, a qualitatively similar finding in their approaches. And I just want to highlight two of them. So one is the exact renormalization group approach to gravity, followed by Martin Reuter, Roberto Bacacci, and many others. And we had a not too long ago, we had a whole workshop about this here at the Institute. But there's also this more recent idea of doing quantum gravity with the idea that at very short Planckian scales, one might have an anisotropy between space and time. So this idea is due to Peter Hojava, called Lifshitz gravity. And it also has, in one of its incarnations, it finds a spectral dimension that exactly has this qualitative behavior. So in the best of all worlds, one would say this points, maybe we are all barking up the right tree. We just don't quite understand yet of how this coincidence of results appear. But we're certainly, I mean, many people are currently thinking about this. So in a way, this might be a very nice calculation one can do kind of in any approach to quantum gravity. And it might help us in discriminating between different approaches. You know, can you calculate that number? Does it come out, you know, the way it comes out in my approach? We don't know whether it's right. But it could assume the status, I would say, of what computing black hole entropy to some degree has in many theories of quantum gravity. So something, some kind of observable in inverted commas, which many is sufficiently generic so that you can actually calculate it in an approach and you can use it to discriminate between different ones. Okay, so my 1.25 hours are almost up. This is just a slide to give you an idea of what we are thinking about. So of course, this is very much work in progress, and many, many things still need to be understood before we can at all be sure that this is describes the right theory of quantum gravity. What we've seen so far is extremely nice, but many more things need to be understood. So we are analyzing in this phase diagram I showed you earlier, and we are still analyzing the order of the phase transitions. There are big numerical challenges in trying to do this, but this is ongoing work, so I won't now comment on it. What I showed there, the curve, was the result of a paper we published in last year, where we found this Lifshitz, this very made the analogy with the Lifshitz phase diagram closer. Well, some analogies and some differences. What we're very interested in trying to understand is how the results that we are presenting, how they relate to this renormalization group approach that people have been following in a quantitative way in this so-called asymptotic safety scenario. And of course, the key to the asymptotic safety scenario is to say there is an ultraviolet fixed point of the renormalization group flow, and this enables us to take a continuum limit there, which is different kind of from the naive continuum limit you would take at a Gaussian fixed point. So this would be, if you could show a relation there, or if you could relate the flows to what we see in our computations, we might be able to verify or falsify this particular claim of the existence of a fixed point. But it's certainly a possible theoretical explanation, if there is such a fixed point, for what we see and why there is something non-trivial, but it's clearly not the only possibility. We have studied metacoupling that gets us immediately into very difficult questions. Even if you just consider a single point mass, it raises a number also of kind of fundamental issues concerning the Wick rotation and how certain things that you observe in Lorentzian signature, just think of the event horizon of a black hole, how they are appropriately translated to kind of a non-perturbative sum over geometries like the one we are evaluating here. So there are many things to be understood here. And of course also related to, I mean, short scale structure, what is this space-time foam or whatever the structure is we see on very short distances? Does it have fractal structures? How can we quantify it? How can we, in the best of all worlds, derive large-scale observational, perhaps, predictions for how such a substructure might be detectable? So there are there are big question marks and many things that still remain to be done. So just to put it, to summarize the story for you, this causal dynamical triangulations approach is a path integral formulation of gravity. It incorporates dynamical character of nature. It also incorporates causal Lorentzian nature of geometry. And it depends on very few ingredients and assumptions. So I have superposition principle. I have the existence of a global time. I have causality. So kind of, many of these things are completely standard. And it has very few free parameters. So, you know, I showed you there's a phase diagram there. So if something badly goes wrong, this is actually a model that can be falsified. And of course, that's not something you can say about many theories of quantum gravity. What is very nice here is that we have an explicit toolbox which enables us to derive, at least within the accuracy, you know, of the numerical simulations, quantitative results. And that is just extremely helpful in trying to understand what is going on in this very non-perturbative context, where we at this stage just have lax analytical tools to say very much. So the statements, of course, I made were of a quantitative nature. I was mapping out the Zitter space for you. I was quantitatively analyzing quantum fluctuations. I gave you a result for the spectral dimension, and so on. So this is what I would call results in quantum gravity. Of course, they are not yet related to anything observable at this stage, but they're kind of numbers which you can compute and try and compare. In principle, our formalism can also be used to just compute predictions or test predictions that come from arbitrary other quantum gravity theories. As long as they can have some effective field theory description to, you know, at least up to some distance from the Planck scale, you might be able, just, you know, you give us your observable and we try and see whether we can measure it. So it's just also very useful as a concrete computational tool. So what we've learned so far is that once you are in a very non-perturbative context, very unexpected things can happen which you could not have guessed just by staring at the formal path integral, just staring at the action. You see, because as we saw very explicitly, entropy gives you crucial contributions to generate what you see. So that's, of course, in a way, is very beautiful, maybe something you would expect, but it also makes it, of course, difficult to treat analytically at this stage before we haven't better understood what precisely it is we are seeing. Dynamical nature of dimension was one example of how something that was completely unexpected from the classical theory, you know, suddenly pops out of such a non-perturbative formulation. So all of this corroborates what I would call my best hopes. I don't know about you. I hope there'll be much more to talk about in the future. And here are just a few reviews where you might learn more about this whole quantization program. And I'm exhausted. And I thank you very much for staying with me. Thank you.
Questions? John?
How do you know you don't get from the singularity conservation?
Well, we don't know. I mean, as I said, I mean, clearly, it's a non-trivial piece of work to relate whatever result now comes out of the Wick-rotated formalism to translate that back into Lorentzian. And we don't at this stage have anything like, you know, of course, Osterwalder-Schrader axioms. And of course, the observables we calculate here, they're of course also, they're not endpoint functions. You know, they're much less local objects, so they're actually quite non-local. So even to formulate exactly what one means by a good rotation and is it allowed or not, well, I think that's an open question, and you have to very critically examine, you know, each of the results you get here. Do they rotate back? How do they rotate back? And immediately when you couple matter to this, you know, even like the single point particle, we exactly run into problems of this type. You know, the Euclidean framework, it encodes certain properties of the Lorentzian theory, but in which way precisely, quantitatively, well, you'll still have to figure out.
It's beautiful work with many beautiful results. To me, the most intriguing is the importance of the global time. Are you far enough along that you could see whether there would be quantum gravity effects that would detect the global time?
No. But what we do see again is that there seems to be no way around, and it seems to be crucially contributing to what we find. Yes.
So I have two questions. First, what does this have to say about the cosmological constant problem?
Okay.
And the second question is the Hojava gravity says, and a more energetic gravitons go faster than less energetic gravitons, basically because you break Lorentz symmetry in Hojava Lipschitz gravity. So is this the same in your, does that somehow emerge in this theory or not?
Okay. So this is the first issue first. In order for this whole setup to work, I need a bare cosmological constant which is positive. Only in that region will my path integral converge at all. But as it turns out, the way I have to fine-tune the cosmological constant also means that the renormalized cosmological constant has to be positive. But there is no, it's a free parameter of the renormalized theory. And in order to measure it, you have to just relate it to certain observables. But it has to be positive. So far we are okay on that count, but it doesn't predict any magnitude. Concerning your second question, of course, concerns have been raised about this anisotropic gravity, especially to kind of extra degrees of freedom it might have in addition to what one wants to have. The construction is a continuum, and what we are doing is rather different. And we don't think that the criticism that applies to the continuum theory applies in the same way here. Because, of course, well, we never started from a continuum gauge redundant formulation to make this very, you know, to make this watertight. We cannot currently, because you would have to study kind of suitable observables which are kind of sensitive, say, to the presence of such modes. And it's unclear what these observables would be at this stage.
I think we're out of time, so we should finish there. But Renato is around for
Until and including Friday, yes.
So let's thank Renato as well.